From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the latest on a lawsuit on behalf of thousands of Michiganders wrongly accused of cheating on their unemployment claims. Plus, Michigan takes another step towards blocking police use of facial recognition technology. We'll have the latest from Lansing. And the vet, who's the new director of the Michigan Veterans Affairs Agency, vows to get more of Michigan's vets connected with their benefits.
My friends, my colleagues have all served, and to see them suffer for lack of knowledge, for lack of education is very, very disheartening to me.
What happens when medical research focuses on white men and male animals?
The biggest questions that patients have is this treatment going to work for me? And so we don't have a lot of confidence to be able to say that, yes, this particular intervention is a good fit for you.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's program, we talk with the new director of the Michigan Veterans Affairs Agency on just how Michigan can do a better job connecting vets with their benefits.
For me, outreach and putting the information and the resources in the hands of veterans is so, so important. And that's my life's mission, whether I'm here in this position or not.
That conversation later in the hour. But first, Michigan's on the road to blocking law enforcement from being able to use facial recognition technology. Let's talk about what has been happening with the facial recognition bill in the Senate as we welcome the sponsor of the bill, Republican State Senator Peter Lucido. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Good to see you. Good to be with you too, Cindy. And you know what? To all the listeners out there.
There you go. Senator, exactly what would your bill do? Or more to the point, what would police and law enforcement not be able to do if this bill becomes law?
Currently, we have what's called real-time facial recognition under the law. And there is no law that prohibits them from doing anything. In fact, to the contrary, there's no law, period. As a result, there's law going to be in place that says you don't need real-time recognition, facial recognition, that is. You see, most, if not all, of our technologies have advanced our laws, which means we're trying to get laws to catch up with technology. Facial recognition is where you're out on the streets, you're walking to a restaurant, you're walking to go to the ballpark, and they have these cameras strategically set to pick up people's faces on cameras and run them through a database, which is set up by the state police, from your driver's license or your state ID cards, and they're trying to match people that have committed crimes, people that are felons, and that is not what our society is. This is Big Brother 1984, Orson Welles all over. We want to stop that and put some barriers in place. Those barriers would be that you're not going to use real-time facial recognition unless it's an exception to the warrant requirement, which we have under law right now. Law enforcement can use their force as well as not go get a warrant when they have exigent circumstances under the law, which that means a bank robbery in progress, a murder that just occurred, that there's somebody being raped. Those are crimes where we don't have to go get a warrant to protect our Fourth Amendment guaranteed constitutional right to be protecting our places, persons, and things, unless a warrant issues. They can get around the warrant requirement when those things occur.
Very extenuating circumstances.
Yeah, you know what, Cynthia? When they go ahead and somebody robs a bank and he's running into a home and the police are in hot pursuit, you don't need to get a warrant because you're pursuing the criminal. And they ran into a house which tried to vitiate them from the crime. The reality is, why are you looking at my picture through a database that I had no rights to begin with because it's a privilege to get a driver's license in the state or a state ID? As such, you submitted under law to be in a database, but they never told you you were going to have real-time facial recognition. Lucido understands that the law has got to be in place. Fairness is what I'm about. And as a state legislator, I want to give the privacy and protection to those individuals that aren't criminals, which is the majority of us, the right not to have our face run through facial recognition unless a warrant is issued.
Now, Detroit police officials say this technology is a tool helping them find suspects after a crime is committed. Are you taking a crime-fighting tool away from law enforcement with this?
Not at all, and here's why. If they believe they need that tool, they have every right to go get a warrant when it's not exigent circumstances and tell a judge why they have to run it through the computer. When I go fly on an airplane, TSA has already got my name, my driver's license number, my date of birth, where I live, and it even has a picture of me. And I've submitted to do a facial recognition when I get in a closed cockpit. That's true with everybody. You're going to go through facial recognition when you go through the airport.
Right.
But they post it. They openly post it saying, you are being ID'd. But on the street, when I'm going down to Slow's to have some barbecue, no one told me that they have cameras out there that they're going to pick up my face. I don't think that that's fair. I don't think it's just, and I don't think it's right to track me or to know where I'm at. Or better yet, run me through a computer when I've done nothing wrong.
So what is next for the bill? Where it bring us up to date. So it's been passed by the Senate?
The bill, overwhelmingly, it is a bipartisan supported bill, which means both sides of the aisle. This isn't about Democrats and Republicans. It's about people's rights and secure to be in their person, places, and things. Because, Cynthia, just like the other bill that deals with your security for your phone, your iPad, your computer, no one from law enforcement should have a right to go into those items unless they have a search warrant. And today we protect ourselves with our data differently than we did before we had a computer. We used to lock them up in safes in our house, those little safes mom and dad and grandma and grandpa had. Today we lock it up in our computer. No one should be able to go into there unless they have a warrant. So we passed out of the Senate. It's on its way to the House for a committee hearing. I think we're going to get the bipartisan support. I think it's something that's good bill, as they say in Lansing. And the reason why is because these individuals know that they want to be protected from this type of behavior, have defined rules in place so we know what the rules are before we start playing a game.
State Senator Peter Lucido of Macomb County, thank you, Senator, for being with us on Stateside and sharing this bill with us.
Always good to talk to you, Cynthia.
A computer system robo-adjudicating thousands and thousands of unemployment claims. That was the cost-cutting move enacted by the Snyder administration. But that computer system, known as Midas, proved to be faulty. It wrongly accused tens of thousands of Michiganders of unemployment fraud. Even as the state admitted its whopping mistake, a suit was filed on behalf of people who were wrongly accused. And late last week, the State Court of Appeals cleared away a last remaining hurdle for the case to proceed. Zach Gorchow of Gongwer News Service is with us now from Lansing. So, Zach, what does this appeals court decision mean for the case?
Well, basically, it means that the case can finally actually go forward and they can stop fighting over technicalities. I should say the state can stop fighting over technicalities and trying to get it kicked on a technicality. This means actually getting into the merits of the claim, discovery, depositions, all that kind of stuff. We're not totally there yet because the state has to decide if it wants to appeal this latest decision by the Michigan Court of Appeals. Which basically said that, yes, the plaintiffs have a legitimate constitutional claim for damages. The state has to decide if it wants to appeal that to the Michigan Supreme Court. If it does, then this fight over the technical matters of the case will continue.
This case was filed, am I right, in 2015?
That is correct.
4 years ago. And when you stop and you think, and I know we've talked about it here on Stateside and you've covered it for Gongwer, these false accusations of fraud put a lot of people through the ringer, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there were at least 1,100 people who were accused of and determined guilty of fraud during this time period from 2013 to 2015 that filed for bankruptcy. Now, there were 37,000 people overall, so I guess you could say that's a relatively small percentage, but I don't think there's anyone who would say the state making decisions and errors that led to 1,100 people filing bankruptcy is anything other than cataclysmic.
What's been the response to this appeals court decision from Governor Whitmer, who, of course, inherited this mess from her predecessor, Governor Rick Snyder?
It's very quiet. Basically, all they're saying is we're looking at it, and that's about the best way to summarize it. One thing that I have to say I was pretty surprised by, and the plaintiff's attorney was pretty agitated about, was that the governor's press secretary described the case as being at a quote-unquote early stage. Now, yes, you could say the case is early in the sense that discovery and depositions haven't even started, But as you said, and as we've talked about, this case is 4 years old. It's only at an early stage because the state has fought tooth and nail to get it dismissed on technicalities. So that upset the plaintiffs. They've been waiting 4 years just to get their day in court. They haven't, you know, they're not there yet. And who knows if the governor's going to decide to appeal this to the Supreme Court. And this is one of the bigger decisions the governor will make upcoming. If she decides to appeal, she's going to have a lot of angry people that usually would be considered allies of hers on her hands. You know, at the same point, she also has a fiduciary responsibility to state government. This is a case that conceivably could cost the state $500 million, maybe more. Remember, you've got 37,000 plaintiffs. For your listeners out there, if you were one of those that was forced into bankruptcy by this, what would be an acceptable amount to you to not just get you back the money that was taken from you, but to account for the damages and stress? You know, the state doesn't exactly just have $500 million sitting around other than its budget stabilization fund, which I don't think it's going to drop half of that all at once to deal with it. So, you know, there is a serious financial aspect that the governor is going to have to weigh here.
So wait and watch to see what happens next. And I'm certain that these over 30,000 people involved in this case are on pins and needles.
These are folks who, you know, financially obviously had a lot of problems. They filed for unemployment. Then the system in place at the time penalizes them. Not only do they have to pay back everything they got in unemployment benefits plus interest, but four times the amount of benefits they received in penalties. So many of these folks were on the hook for $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 or more, had their wages garnished, state income tax funds intercepted. Like I said, several were forced into bankruptcy. I mean, it's just an absolute nightmare for people. I don't know anybody who doesn't think that the state didn't royally screw up on this. The question is that they've been fighting is whether the lawsuit was filed on time. I mean, it took 4 years to get an all clear for the plaintiffs that their lawsuit was filed on time. That's what this fight has been all about.
Zach Orchow from Gongmer News, keeping an eye out for us. Thank you so much, Zach.
Good to be with you.
Coming up, what role should race and gender play in scientific research?
Research is research. What does it matter if we don't have people from different cultures, from different genders, from different age ranges represented? But in reality, that's a huge issue because we can't really trust that those results apply to different people when they're only tested on white populations.
That's next, right here on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Medical research saves lives. There's no arguing that fact. But here's a disconnect. Patients are every gender, every race, but medical research has historically been more focused on white men or male test animals and less on females and people of color. So let's talk about what that means. Jamie Mitchell is an assistant professor of social work at the University of Michigan, investigator with the Michigan Center for Urban African American Aging Research, and co-director of the Healthier Black Elders Center in Detroit, and Jill Becker, chair of the biopsychology area at the University of Michigan School of Psychology. It is so good to have you both here. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having us.
My pleasure.
So, Jamie, tell me how much of a disparity overall are we seeing in the race of human participants in health research?
I think depending on the type of research it is, we see a pretty large disparity. And that's for a number of reasons, right? Some of it can be that some researchers find it difficult to include diverse samples or to maybe build the type of trust that's required to kind of get diverse participants engaged in research. But sometimes I think it's just being oblivious and just thinking research is research. What does it matter if we don't have, you know, different people from different cultures, from different genders, from different age ranges represented? But in reality, that's a huge issue because we can't really trust that those results apply to different people when they're only tested on white populations.
And Jill, what about disparities in sex in terms of animal subject research, which is a very big thing in psychology?
So in terms of animal subjects, it depends on the particular field of medicine or psychology that's being studied. But it ranges from 70 to 90% male subjects in most of the research that's being done.
So the bottom line, I guess, we have to ask is why should the average person care about whether their race or their sex is represented in medical research?
Well, in terms of sex, we know that there are sex differences throughout the body and in the brain, all of which affect the outcome of the results of particular pilot studies or experimental studies that are going to lead to new therapies for humans. And most of the sex differences in animals are reflected in sex differences in humans, so that if you only study males, you're developing therapies that are not going to apply to women when they move to clinical trials. And that can result in a lot of money wasted and failed efforts to even find a therapy for particular medical disorders such as depression, where 90% of the subjects are male in the basic animal research, but you know, three times as many women suffer from anxiety and depression.
What's your take on this, Jamie?
I think it's the same when you're thinking about race and also ethnicity and culture, in the sense that, you know, I also study doctor-patient communication. And one of the biggest questions that patients have is this treatment going to work for me, right? Mm-hmm. And so we don't have a lot of confidence to be able to tell patients, yes, we've actually tested this Alzheimer's intervention, this depression intervention with people who look like you, who may have a similar background and upbringing as you, who may have faced some of the same stressors, such as discrimination, as you. And so we don't have a lot of confidence to be able to say that, yes, this particular intervention is a good fit for you. And that trial and error doesn't sound so good when it's you and it's your body. I mean, it's your disease, right? And so we really need more diversity in the way that we test different behavioral interventions, all kinds of research, so that we can say with more confidence, yes, we have treatments that are better suited to the background, the culture, the experiences, you know, maybe the social norms, the way that masculinity is expressed differently in different cultures. And so we need more research that better engages different populations so that we can have that confidence.
To that point, can either of you pull up an example in layman's terms, either from your own research or for other projects you know about some advancement or some finding that may not have been found if there was only a focus on males or on whites?
Mm-hmm. I know, for example, I don't do this particular area of work, but we have a good body of knowledge on prostate cancer research. And one of the things that we now know is that African-American men have a much higher prevalence of prostate cancer. And so they're getting it at earlier ages in their 50s and 60s, as opposed to 70s and 80s. They also have higher mortality from prostate cancer, right? And they also need to be screened differently. So maybe more quickly, sooner in life, or more aggressively, particularly if they have a family history. And so without research that specifically looks at the way that prostate cancer operates in African-American men, we would continue to see these disparities in death and in disease that all of our current recommendations had been set to white males, and those just didn't apply to black males.
We are talking about life and death.
Absolutely.
In cardiovascular disease, for example, has been primarily thought to be a male disorder. All of the research was done on males, and even the characterization of it was described in terms that fit males. And yet now we know that it's the number one killer of women, and the symptoms are different for men and women. And when you start doing the basic animal research, you discover the mechanisms mediating how the plaques are formed and so on are different because of the presence of estrogen in the blood.
Absolutely.
So it's, you know, the sex differences in how the research was initially designed have led to gross disparities in outcomes for men and women.
Knowing that, it is to an outsider, to a layperson watching, kind of mind-blowing that it wasn't obvious and that, you know, there weren't female animals included in this study. As you say, was it just because it didn't occur to researchers in the past?
Well, in terms of sex differences, I think the underlying premise in basic research was that if it was important, it would be present in both males and females. And the little differences weren't important. They weren't fundamental to the disease. And yet now we know, even when the behavior, you know, the way that males and females present is the same, the underlying neurological or biological mechanisms mediating the disease can be very different. And so we're now coming to understand that fundamental differences are present throughout the brains and bodies of males and different that just aren't reflected in the commonalities.
And I think we've just evolved as a society as well mm-hmm. to recognize the importance of studying differences, both differences between groups and also differences within groups, right? And so, for example, at the federal level, we now have a National Institute of Minority Health and Health Disparities. That's the youngest institute we have at the National Institutes of Health, right? So it took many years for that standalone institute to kind of come into its own and to get some federal funding and to be able to fund the type of researchers who will do this specific type of work that's needed.
I'm interested, Jill, through your work in biopsychology at U of M, how has it been for you to get funding for research on female subjects?
Well, so I've been doing this research since the late 70s.
It's been a while. You've got some perspective for us.
So, yeah, I joined the faculty in 1987, and I have been studying sex differences throughout my career. It has always been tough. I have always had to justify studying both males and females in a way that other people don't have to justify the research that they're doing. So I've had to argue for the fundamental importance of how males' changes in the brains are different from females' changes in the brains. So arguing that the underlying neurochemistry and neurobiology is important to understand for both sexes.
Is it getting any better?
It is getting better. The National Institutes of Health, the NIH, have mandated that both male and female subjects be included not only in clinical research, but in basic research now. People now need to argue why they're not including both males and females. That makes it easier for you to study both males and females. It still is necessary to justify studying sex differences because you need to include larger numbers of animals in order to have enough subjects for the statistical analyses that allow you to know for sure that there's something going on there.
On the social behavioral side, we're kind of on the opposite side, or we have the opposite experience. And so those of us who study within group, right? So we might say, you know, diabetes is a particular issue among Latinx or Latino males and a growing issue among African-American males. And we just like to study those groups, right? And so a lot of times the pushback that we get is why not study them in relation to white males, right? And so we also often have to also make the argument there is some value in just studying particular populations of people who are really burdened by a disease and they deserve to be kind of studied and understood in their own context and not always have to be compared to a white reference population as well.
So in terms of your work, you know, you're with the health your Black Elders mm-hmm. Center. You are with the Michigan Center for Urban African American yes. Aging Research. Let's understand the funding fight for anybody in yes. science. It's the hill you die on every
that's
day
right,
getting
that's
funding.
Right.
But what about, you know, the kind of specific research you're doing?
So I think we've been really fortunate because we are funded under what's called the Resource Centers on Minority Aging. And so as it stands since last year, there are 18 centers around the country that study different minority populations and their health issues around aging, right? And so because I think we're working in relation to aging, which is something we're all going to deal with or are dealing with, it's a very important issue in this country, there's some pretty robust federal funding for those who are prepared and are doing that kind of work. And we've been able to tap into that. But I think if we weren't nested under that kind of title or under that research theme, we might be struggling just as badly with other groups who are out here trying to do work on particular sex or gender or race or ethnic differences as well.
That was Jamie Mitchell, who's an assistant professor of social work at the University of Michigan. She's joined today by Jill Becker, who's chair of the biopsychology area at U of M's Department of Psychology, as we explore disparity in who is participating in healthcare research, whether it be human, whether it be animal. The National Institutes of Health, you kind of alluded to this, they've been working since 1993 to push for more inclusive research studies, including that mandate that all research funded by the NIH include women and minorities. So 1993, 2019, why are we still talking about disparity?
Well, the inclusion of women in clinical research at the NIH in 1993 was an important change in the federal mandate, but it didn't require that enough women be included in research that we were able to come up with findings that separated the results by sex. We don't have enough data at this point to even know whether many of the things that we have been studying are different for males and females. The result has been males and females have been lumped together in the data analysis because for most clinical trials, it's about 60% men and 40% women. And that usually isn't enough to be able to parse apart the differences between the sex or genders.
And what's the answer to researchers who argue, well, I can get more men to say yes than women?
It's actually the opposite way around, believe it or not. I would say that depending on the type of work you're doing, certainly in behavioral research, the vast majority of research participants are women. So at the Healthier Black Elders Center, we actually have a registry of volunteer research participants who are trained in research and they are ready to participate in non-invasive research. It's called a participant resource pool, 85% women. We have about 1,500 African-American older adults in that pool, 85% women. And so our challenge is actually in recruiting men who are, you know, trusting the research process and willing to engage. Yeah.
In clinical trials, it tends to be more men than women, primarily because women frequently have to deal with childcare issues. And if they're inpatient studies, it's much more difficult to get women to participate.
So what kinds of important changes do each of you think need to be made in the research world and in the funding world to close this gap we're talking about in sex and race?
Yeah. So one of the challenges that we're finding is there was an article that recently came out through, I want to say NIH. It was looking at NIH rates of funding and the types of researchers who get the money, right, to do this important work. And what they recently found, and it was picked up by several different news outlets, is that unfortunately, the types of researchers who study behavioral interventions, who actually work with communities, and so they don't necessarily work with cells or work at the molecular level, but they work around helping people to stop smoking, helping people to exercise more.
Visible stuff.
Yeah. It's pretty tough because you've got to build trust and you've got to spend some time in these communities to kind of build those relationships. And you've got to work with behavioral interventions, which can be, you know, pretty tough. But those people actually tend to get funded significantly less than folks who do basic science, bench science, molecular science.
Funded less.
Yes, they do. And those researchers also tend to be researchers of color. And so if you're thinking about who's going into communities, recruiting people of color to do work on disparities that impact people of color, it's usually people who came from those communities, grew up, got a PhD or an MD, and decided to go back and reinvest in those communities. And they have a more difficult time getting behavioral or intervention-based funding than folks who do more lab-based work. And so that is a disparity that just came out in the research.
So I think for research that studies both sexes, what is happening is everybody has to study both sexes now. And there's some really interesting results that are starting to drive the science. I see new graduate students really wanting to study sex differences or both males and females more often these days than they did 10 years ago. And people are discovering that there are some really interesting scientific differences between the sexes that I think is going to start increasing the attention and the excitement around the inclusion of females and women in basic and clinical research. For example, if you look at depression in both animal models and in humans, if you look at just the genetic changes associated with anxiety and depression, the genes that are changed in both sexes that overlap is in the single digits. It's a very small overlap between the genetic effects on the brain of depression. So we call this the same disease in males and females, and yet it, you know, what's going on in the brain is so different that we can't even see that much of an overlap.
And I think there are more researchers. I think about the way that Alzheimer's, for example, is being funded at a pretty high rate right now by the National Institutes of Health, which is kind of our main federal body that provides grant funding for this type of work. And I think a lot of researchers are actually partnering with basic scientists and bringing together behavioral science and basic science and saying, okay, what can depression is a multifaceted issue, just like diabetes or heart disease, right? Health is messy. It involves where you work and the stress and where you live and pollution and all of these different things. And so how can we get together with basic scientists and write grant applications that involve the kinds of mechanisms that the government will actually fund, but also really try to get at the heart of what's happening in people's daily lives that you can't control in a lab?
The students sitting in your classroom today are going to be unleashed on the world.
That's
and
right.
What do you think is going to happen?
Well, I think they're going to be really excited to go out and study sex differences. They're outraged when they hear me say that these studies, these drugs weren't even tested on women, and they're just giving them to them as though they're small men. And they're not actually even adjusting for size, usually. And so they are charged to go out there and begin to study both sexes and begin to learn what's going on. So I'm excited for the future.
Absolutely. And our Michigan Center for Urban African American Aging Research, one of the things that we are charged to do by the federal government is to train up-and-coming junior scientists. And so over the past 20 years, long before I came into the group, they have trained over 70 junior scientists, most of whom identify as minority or underrepresented. And all of them are focused on disparities work with mostly older African American adults. And so they're excited to do this work. We're helping them get funding to do this work. And they've had a lot of success over the years because of that support.
Fascinating conversation. I want to thank you so much, Jill Becker, who is chair of the biopsychology area at U of M's Department of Psychology, and Jamie Mitchell, an investigator with the Michigan Center for Urban African American Aging Research. And also, she co-directs the Healthier Black Elders Center in Detroit. Great talking with both of you. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for having me.
Before we take a quick break, I have some news for you. I want to let you know I'm very pleased to announce Michigan Radio has chosen my replacement as host of Stateside for After I Retire at the end of this year. Veteran public radio journalist April Baer joins us from Oregon Public Radio as her family returns to their Midwest stomping grounds. To learn more about April, just head over to michiganradio.org. And April, welcome. Coming up, we speak with the new director of the Michigan Veterans Affairs Agency about what she wants to change.
A lot of the programs and resources that are out there are in silos, and it's our job at the MVAA to bring all those things to the helm into one place in order to be able to service veterans in the state.
That is next here on Stateside. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Healthcare, education, job assistance. Military vets are entitled to these benefits and many more like them, but too many of Michigan's 600,000 vets are not getting those benefits. Michigan's in the bottom five states when it comes to connecting our vets with their benefits. And that is something the new director of the Michigan Veterans Affairs Agency wants to change. She is here with us now from Lansing. Director Zanetta Adams, welcome, and it's good to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me here.
You took up your new post this past summer. Would you tell us a little about your background? Are you a vet?
I am. So I served 8 years between the Army National Guard, and Army Reserves. And I was discharged medically in 2005 off of falling from a deuce and a half truck with the rails up. So about a 10-foot fall. That was fun.
So what was it about this position that drew you to it? What do you see as your mission statement?
So I would say, not even just for this position, but for my life is about advocacy. So just a little bit of a historical background. When I was injured, there were a lack of resources available for me. I had three children at home at the time, my first set of twins. I have two sets. And I was in a wheelchair and struggling and didn't have a place to turn. So I dove into this really deep depression and was suicidal, and it was just a struggle for me. And so when I was finally able to get out of that situation and work through the VA process and trying to apply for benefits, I decided that I wanted to help other veterans to not have to deal with the stress that I had to deal with. So I went back to school. I went to law school and got my law degree and made it my career goal to help veterans get their compensation and pension benefits. And through that process, started a nonprofit for women veterans to help them with peer support, mentorship, and resources and retreats. So an advocate is what arose out of my injuries and situation. And so for me, outreach and putting the information and the resources in the hands of veterans is so, so important. And that's my life's mission, whether I'm here in this position or not.
Which is certainly something needed in Michigan, where we have done kind of abysmally bad in connecting veterans with their benefits. And I know you spent a lot of this fall going around the state. You held a series of 13 listening sessions. What did you hear?
So, it just depended on where I went. So there were groups of veterans who were very frustrated about the process of how to get benefits, to advocates who were frustrated about not knowing about the different resources out there, to veterans who were dealing with emergency situations and were in crisis who had no idea the wealth of information from the trust fund to other funding sources and resources that were available. So these listening sessions really helped to reiterate and solidify the notion in my mind that a lot of the programs and resources that are out there are in silos, and it's our job at the MVAA to bring all those things to the helm into one place in order to be able to serve as veterans in the state.
Director Adams, was there anything you heard that really took you by surprise?
You know, one of the listening sessions we went to, and I can't remember which city it was in, but there was a 93-year-old veteran who was he was very, very emotional, to the point he was in tears and felt like he wanted to give up. And he was a part of the American Legion, the VFW. I mean, like, he was a part of all the veteran service organizations. And to hear that he was trying to navigate this process by himself and felt like he had no one to help him was astounding to me, because he's in spaces where veterans are. And so I think there's an assumption that if you're in these spaces, we don't have to target those veterans because they know the information, because they're amongst veterans. But that was really astounding to me to learn that someone who's so ingrained in those types of environments did not know or did not have those resources or was not utilizing them. So.
And over the past few years, we on Stateside have covered veterans' issues in depth, and we have heard that from veterans. As you say, it's stunning that you have a World War II veteran in tears because he couldn't connect. So here we have Michigan ranking near the bottom nationally when it comes to connecting its more than 600,000 veterans to those federal benefits they've earned. Benefits that could change a veteran's life, as you've seen yourself. Here's Air Force vet Stephanie Zarb speaking on our show last month. Take a listen, and we can talk about this on the other side.
Michigan veterans lag behind their peers in other states. We are less likely to have access to our benefits, and those who do get access to their benefits tend to do so at a lower rate than our peers in other states. And this is happening despite the fact that here in Michigan, we actually spend more on veteran programming than other states, which is really hard to kind of put your head around why that's happening.
Director Adams, what is your take on this? Why can't Michigan do a better job here?
So I will say the number that we're talking about is the GDX. We're talking about the number that the VA provides for all of the types of money, federal dollars that are coming into a state. And so they take that all into consideration in ranking states as to being connected to benefits. Some of those numbers we can't control. So, for instance, how many healthcare service providers are in the state through the VA. That's something that we can't control, but that's a ding against us. There's the number of cemeteries. So pretty much the number of federal dollars that the VA is spending within the state all takes into account where we fall as a state. So part of our job is to advocate to the VA to bring more of those types of resources. It's a hard sell at times because we don't have an active duty base. We don't have that huge active duty base of folks coming out, transitioning right out of the military to go into these VA spaces. So that's a harder sell to get those types of things.
But the actually getting the veterans connected and,
right.
and having the right people to guide them through so they're not out there kind of in the wilderness trying to sort through this maze on their own. Why haven't we done better for them?
So I will say this. I can't speak to what has happened in the past, but my number one goal at this agency is outreach. And I'm not talking about just outreach to the service providers or the organizations. I'm talking about outreach to the veterans, putting the education in their hands. One of the things I can tell you in the state of Michigan is that our veteran population is an older veteran population, and it's a population that's a prideful population. They don't need those benefits. If you hear them talk, we don't necessarily need that benefit, or somebody else more deserving deserves that benefit. And so really not only educating them, but getting them to understand that this benefit and applying for a benefit that you've so rightly earned and deserved is not just for you. You're helping your family as well. And so that is part of the education piece that we need to do. So our outreach efforts are going to be within the same funding that we have right now. We're looking at innovative ways to get more boots on the ground so that we can really get into spaces where veterans are to educate them, because that's really the key.
And what about, as you say, boots on the ground, the coordinators, the ones that are, we hear that there seems to be not enough to be able to reach our body of veterans.
And I agree, there are not enough. We have 10 prosperity regions at this time where we have 8 coordinators out to serve, 83 counties in the state of Michigan with 600,000 veterans and 350,000 dependents and spouses in the state of Michigan. That's a huge ask on one person.
Yeah, it's a lot of people. That ratio is kind of shocking.
Yeah. So we're looking at ways right now, as we speak. I mean, I just walked out of a meeting today where we're looking at ways that we can actually have more folks out there that are trained on all of the resources and information that can be provided on a federal level, as well as what we can provide from some of the state benefits to go into places where dependents are too, because we need to make sure, and I don't know how much you know about the veteran community, but many times it's the dependents and the spouses that bring the veteran to those benefits, because sometimes that veteran's unwilling to get there themselves. And so we need to educate the dependents and the spouses on the benefits as well.
Will you be bringing in certified veteran service officers? They have to be certified. Will you be doing that?
So we have 5 veteran service officers that we employ right now. And as you may know, within state government, we are only allotted a certain number of full-time employees. So to be able to bring on some of those additional ones, we cannot. However, what we have been doing is we've been providing free accredited service officer training to anyone who wants to have that and who wants to be an advocate. They just have to be accredited through a veteran service organization. And so we'll provide the training for no cost for those people to get out there. And we continuously fill up those training spots for people who are looking to learn how to provide service provision.
Director Adams, how will you measure success? What kind of metrics do you have in your mind to measure success in connecting our Michigan vets with their benefits?
So we have a map that we use to see where county service provision is and how many federal dollars are going to each of those counties. So one of the first things I want to do is target those counties where there is a higher veteran population but a lower number of federal dollars being spent, to be able to see us get into the top third of states or in the top third of service provision for compensation and pension and aid in attendance, those types of benefits, is a win for me. Right now, we are well below that. And part of our strategic planning over we have a 30-year plan in place right now, but working even over the next 10 years, we're looking to raise that number by providing benefits. So it's going to require us also looking at how we measure that, because as I said, the GDX, it encompasses all of those federal benefits, but we need to be able to break it down and educate the public on what we're actually looking at. And that's the compensation and pension benefits, those things that we can control. And so we're looking to bring that up into the top third of states within the nation.
And do you have a time frame in mind? Do you have a goal, how many years or how many months, whatever? What do you have in mind?
So our hope is to be able to bring that up within the next 10 years, but our strategic plan is a 30-year plan. And so we can't just bring the number up. We have to put things in place that are going to sustain that number. And because I know the number rose a few years ago from, I think it was 50 to 48, and then now we're back at 50 on that GDX calendar. But we just brought on a data specialist into our team to actually really help us to assess what those numbers look like for compensation and pension and aid in attendance and those types of tangible benefits that we can provide, tangible financial benefits that we can provide to veterans. And so we're going to be able to break that number down and be able to really show where we are on the national scale. And then we're going to seek to be a top third initially, but then we want to be in the top 10 of those states.
Why is this mission so important?
Because I was there. It's important to me because I have children who are dependents who I have to leave a legacy for. I have my friends, my colleagues have all served, and to see them suffer for lack of knowledge, for lack of education, is very, very disheartening to me. And so it's important to me that they have the tools necessary to be successful. And that's important because we're seeing a rise in the suicide rate among veterans as well in the state of Michigan. And so the trend is that when they're connected to benefits, they're less likely to commit suicide. And so if you're seeing the trend rise, that means there are more people that are not connected to benefits. And so to lose one of my brothers and sisters that I served with or served alongside with is disheartening to me. One is too many. So we have to continue to supply them with the tools that are going to make them be successful.
Zanetta Adams is the director of the MVAA, the Michigan Veterans Affairs Agency. Director Adams, thank you for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you so much, Cindy.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
This superb One Direction highway is engineered for easy grades and for speed with safety. The echoes of that two-cylinder motor have never died, and they never will.
Call the turn signal! Use it! Learn to drive!
Here for our latest installment of Learn to Drive is Lieutenant Mike Shaw of the Michigan State Police. Welcome back.
Thank you.
So, class, today's lesson, the center turn lane. We use them for getting onto a busy road and getting off, and, of course, left turns, which can be dicey, are a star feature of that process. So what mistakes do troopers see people make using that center turn lane?
So when we talk about the center turn lane, we'll talk about what the law says, and then we'll talk about what really happens.
Okay.
So the law is very clear that the center turn lane is to make turns only at the next very intersection. It's not to cut across halfway across the road and then pull in there and turn your signal on and wait. You're supposed to actually enter the roadway all the way across, not use that center turn lane to get across. Now, we all know, we see it every day. People do it. Police officers do it. Everybody does it where you know you can get across the first two lanes, but you can't get across to the second ones. So you stop in the center lane, you pull in there, and you kind of wait.
Mm-hmm.
Technically, if you get in a traffic crash, that crash is your fault because you got in that lane without using it to turn. The second thing that the law says is when you're using it to make a left turn, you can't jump into it a quarter mile ahead because traffic is backed up.
Use it as your own private lane.
Use it as your own lane. You're actually supposed to turn at the next available intersection, and that's where you kind of turn. So you have to remember that as well, because if you're in there and somebody actually is doing it correctly, they don't see you and they pull over and you guys get in a crash. That also is a person that's violating that left lane rule, so to speak. So the best way I kind of explain it to people is to understand that if you get in a crash and you're using that left lane, you're at fault. That's regardless. Can you get stopped for it? You sure can. Anytime that a police officer observes you doing that, that's you're breaking the law. You can be stopped for it.
Okay.
If you decide that that's how you're going to get across, and there's some roadways that there's no way that you're going to get across, try to do it as safely as you can. You know, pull in there and don't continue to drive in the lane. You know, stop, turn your turn signal on, and kind of get over. I feel like I'm telling people how to break the law now instead mm-hmm. of help. But, you know, sometimes common sense prevails, and the only way that you're going to get across these busy streets is that way. But realize that if something happens or a crash occurs, then the courteousness goes away and you can get cited.
And you get the points and the fine.
Absolutely.
All right. What about this situation? Not in the center lane. I'm on the main street. Let's say Southfield Road, which I drive very often, which is two and sometimes three lanes. And I'm in that inner lane, that left lane of that two or three lane road. And we're all kind of braked. We're waiting. Someone is in that center lane indicating wanting to turn left in front of me. Do I let that person go, wave them through, or do I just let them sit and, too bad, wait till it all clears? And I'm going to say a disclaimer. My husband says, don't do that because the drivers in those outer lanes don't know that you're being nice and you could wind up having this great big accident.
So, again, it's courtesy. As you're driving along, you should be paying attention to when that happens. So if you see the vehicle in the left lane stopped,
yeah,
you know, and that inner
indicated
lane there stopped, mm-hmm, you should probably know that, hey, something's coming up there. And if you're the driver in that left lane, you should start to turn, but also realize that the other people won't go. So even if somebody, and this is another tough part of where the law is the law, if somebody waves you along and you start to turn and you get in a traffic crash, You did not yield, and the law says that you're at fault. So I always say, if you're courteous enough, I always let, if I can stop, and again, you know, I have an advantage of having a police car, but also when I'm not in one.
Say, when you're being a civilian.
When I'm not in a car, yeah. I will also let them in. But, you know, you kind of got to make eye contact with them. You can help them along. If you see somebody coming, you know, oh, stop or whatever. But you play it by ear. But if you're the one actually making the turn movement, know that just because somebody said, hey, come on, that doesn't give you the right just to travel across all those lanes and get in that crash.
And you could get T-boned.
Correct.
All right. Lieutenant Mike Shaw, Michigan State Police. Great talking traffic with you. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Laura Weber-Davis, Tad Davis, Adam Reyes, and Catherine Newhan. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.